News Centre at 5. Four senior journalists at the Sun newspaper have been cleared of paying public officials. It was alleged they'd bought information, including stories about the Duke of Cambridge and Prince Harry. Royal editor Duncan Larcombe spoke outside the Old Bailey.
There is no celebration whilst this witch hunt continues against my colleagues who still are facing the nightmare that I hopefully one day will wake up from.
Meanwhile, reporting restrictions were lifted over Bettina Jordan-Barber, an MOD official jailed in January after receiving £100,000 for selling stories to The Sun. More than 130 people are now thought to have died in a series of suicide bombings at two mosques in Yemen's capital. Islamic State claims it carried out the attacks. A 19-year-old man inspired by Lee Rigby's murder has been sentenced to 22 years in jail. Rustam Ziamani from South London plotted to behead a British soldier. A coroner's recorded a verdict of suicide at the inquest into a woman who was the subject of a Sky News report into online trolling. But the coroner also said no one could have known that Brenda Leyland, who had a history of depression, was definitely intending to take her own life. Millions of people across the UK have been watching the first major solar eclipse since 1999. Nick Qureshi reports.
Cloud threatened to block the spectacle, so there was delight on the Faroe Islands when it cleared.
Oh, look, just up there, we can actually see a glimpse of it.
10,000 tourists travelled there to catch a glimpse of the astronomical phenomenon, with some coming from Pennsylvania.
This is a thrill in itself, to be this dark at 9 o'clock in the morning, it's like 9 o'clock at night.
The Faroe Islands saw a 100% blackout. Astronomer Tom Kurz says we'll have to wait ages for the next one.
Looking ahead to 2090, we can be very specific about that. That will actually be August of 2090.
There won't be another partial eclipse on this scale in the UK for 11 years.
And the UK's main share index has hit a record high. The FTSE 100 has climbed above the 7,000 mark. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
You can count on us to put Bristol music first. Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, Old Labour Oxford economist is here, Martin Summers is here too, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth, Matthew Malias. After the 6 o'clock news, the BBC are in court next week for aiding and abetting terrorism. Taking them on is Matt Campbell, whose brother died in the 9/11 attacks. Have the BBC to this very day been providing cover for the real 9/11 terrorists? If so, could heads roll at the corporation? Also, the last protesters have been torn out of the trees at Stapleton Allotments and small holdings to make way for the Metro bus. At last, Bristolians will get an up-to-date transport system worthy of a 21st century city. Or will we? We ask Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures. Plus, delayed from previous weeks, the banned vicar of Virginia Water in Surrey. He can't talk about the Middle East in his Anglican church services, but he can talk, because it was pre-recorded before the Bishop of Guildford banned him. We hear from the Reverend Stephen Sizer with a breakdown on the modern medieval-style heresy so popular in the US, that is, Christian Zionism and also Israeli Zionism. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, mainly dry. Temperatures highs of 10 Celsius this weekend. Sunny spells on Saturday and even more sunny on Sunday. Next week, highs again around 10, sunshine and showers. Next weekend, that's the 28th and 29th of March, highs of 11, inching up some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth, Matthew Malias. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Good afternoon, Tony.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself. You're a fairly new councillor. I think last year you became...
Yep, last May was my election. Fairly new to politics. Very interested in the local community, or the community I was born in and grew up in. Lance Weston, stroke Shirehampton, Avonmouth.
Why the Conservative Party rather than one of the other parties?
Well, I believe the local Conservative Party represents me very well, to be honest. Having met Charlotte Leslie, North Bristol MP, and Mark Weston, the Henbury councillor, who is currently the leader of our party, they spoke to me, and it's essentially I believed in them and they believed in me.
But what about your background? This isn't the first thing you've done since you left school, I'm sure. Give us a broader picture of yourself.
Yeah. I grew up in Lance Weston, spent 28 years of my life there. Went to Lance Weston School, then on to Portway School, Community School. Always worked in Avonmouth, various companies, production companies, and
Give us a bit of an insight there, because for many people it's a sort of giant security wall with barbed wire fences and somewhere in the distance maybe some docks. What goes on behind the barbed wire?
Well, I mean, Avonmouth's full of thousands of companies, hundreds and thousands of companies, varying from basic warehousing to production to the Bloodhound, speed racing group, GKN, aerospace companies, everyday items like beer, wine.
Is there very much in the way of shipping going in and out of Avonmouth nowadays, or is it all the other side?
There's a few bits of shipping going into Avonmouth. Mainly there, that's quite similar products. Animal feed being one, sand being dredged from the Severn Estuary, fruit coming in, and there's three or four main processing plants for those on the Bristol side of the docks, on the Portbury docks, as you know, car plants, car storage, and a few other things like coal.
Okay, but really it's seen better days, hasn't it? I mean, even though originally Bristol city centre itself, the harbour, was the port, it moved out to Avonmouth and Portway, and now it seems that traffic's really going elsewhere. You don't see a lot of big ships going in. I mean, if you stood, say, for example, at Portishead, there's not a lot of traffic, is there?
Well, no, I mean, a lot of the big ships require a deep sea container port. And obviously, in days gone by, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, Avonmouth was a thriving area. My grandfather, my father worked at the docks, and it was, there was a cinema and there was cafe, lots of cultures coming into the docks. Yeah, it has dwindled in the recent years, but it was dwindling up until 1990, and then it sort of, it hit a plateau, and now it's slowly rising with the help of, various groups.
Now, I think, am I right in saying that the docks is being sold off by the City Council? What do you think of that? I mean, surely that's something that the city's invested in over the hundreds of years, Is it right to sell it off to a private company?
Well, I believe it's right to sell it off at this point. Essentially, it was sold at a 150-year lease anyway in 1991. So, at the end of those 150 years, it'll most likely be underwater. Possibly in a sense of climate warning. That's a joke, by the way. Essentially, £10 million, it represents a good investment. It allows them to borrow money for the very deep sea port that I mentioned in the last sort of conversation there.
All right. So, when you were working at in the docks or wherever you were about in Portishead, give us an idea of what the sort of stuff you were doing in there.
Well, I worked for a few different companies in my time. I worked for the bakery in Avonmouth, which is quite a large, well-known bakery, as you know. I work for.
Go on, you can name him if you want.
I forget, it's not the BBC. I work for Hovis. Basically, and then I work for a company that mended pallets, which is very good to me. That gave me a good wage.
And when you were working, did you think I really want to get into politics? I want to change things. What made you take that step?
Well, no, I didn't think I wanted to get into politics. I wanted to help my community, help my sports club, help the youth club. Help the local people that I've grown up with and know so well. Unfortunately or fortunately, the best way to do that is to get your hands dirty in politics, or at least local politics.
Now, Avonmouth really is almost a place in looking that's searching for something to do, because there were lots and lots of people living there working in the docks. The docks is all being run down slowly but surely. That's a bit of a poison chalice for you as a councillor, isn't it, having to be in an area which has kind of lost its direction, its purpose of being, almost?
Well, you see the docks is running down, and possibly the docks in terms of boats are running down. The dock land is full of warehousing and different companies that employ thousands of people all across Avonmouth, there as far to Severn Beach and South Gloucester. Again, as I mentioned, hundreds of companies. With the links to the M5 and the sort of rail links, it's a perfect place to be for a company.
It's that little tiny train line thing that goes to Severn Beach. Crikey, yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, I suppose if you've got bulk freight of some sort, then it's quite handy, isn't it? Okay, well, let's look at some of the stories in the news this week. One of the most there's been a few sort of big stories here in Bristol. One of them is the Avon and Somerset Police are talking about sharing services with it looks like Wiltshire, but the annoying Bristol Post website doesn't like letting you see things. As soon as you're trying to read something, something pops out into your face. It's the most irritating website in the entire planet, bristolpost.co.uk. Just as you're in the middle of reading something, suddenly something else comes across. But anyway, the actual headline is Avon and Somerset Police and Wiltshire Constabulary are to share services. Martin Summers, let's get you to start on this one, because there's been a lot of pressure over the years, hasn't there, for police forces, different forces, to consolidate into maybe one covering an entire region. And that looks like it's what's starting to happen here. Sue Mount Stevens, the Police and Crime Commissioner, says that there's going to be savings of £30 million. There's Avon and Somerset sharing services from Wiltshire. Will save apparently 30 million. The two forces confirmed earlier this year it would be embarking on a strategic alliance to save cash. Now, there's not really a lot of talk in here about what might not work about this, but what are your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts is I would speak to Kevin Phillips from the Police Federation and say, well, what are your thoughts, Kevin? I mean, if it's a rational thing to do, then fine, but if it's a way of trying to basically do more with less because we're not spending as much as we ought to spend, well, that's another issue, isn't it?
The two authorities are adamant the move is not a merger and has confirmed that policing will remain locally managed and the two chief constables and two police and crime commissioners will remain in place. Matthew, what's your thoughts about that?
Well,
sharing services between the different forces?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they like to do these things. I agree with Martin in a sense. It seems to be the only reason they like to do these things is to merge to authorities, save the money, and that means redundancies and, you know, cutting costs. And as we all know, human cost is the biggest cost to a business, so that would be the first one they'll save. So that means redundancies and a lack of service on the streets, a lack of police walking around the area.
The only thing I would say about this article in the Bristol Post is it doesn't say anything at all about exactly what services are going to be merged. So you've got a headline with almost nothing below it, I'm afraid. So I'll have a little look and see if we can find out a little bit more about that before the end of the show. Also, should we say a little bit closer to home, in the carriage works, controversial plans for the eyesore carriage works are receiving widespread objection, apparently. There is still just about time to object to these plans or to say you think they're wonderful if you want. That's Fifth Capital. Apparently, there's going to be actually a development on Stokescroft, finally, after the council threatened again to compulsorily purchase the carriage works and Westmoreland House. Next to it, the old big old multi-storey building. It looks as if Fifth Capital might be doing something, but I was chatting to someone the other day who's a reasonably big developer in the city, and they're saying they don't think that they actually really even intend to do it. It's just a way of blocking the council doing a compulsory purchase order on the place. And also, apparently, the Fifth Capital directors have to be in the UK to be served with the legal papers in order to actually carry out the compulsory purchase order, and many of them like to stay out of Britain, so they have to wait till they arrive at the airport to serve the papers on them. Anyway, Martin, again, you first on this one. This has been a kind of running sore, hasn't it, Stokescroft? Yeah. And also with the Tesco riots a couple of years ago, there's a lot of feeling of anger, I suppose, about the idea of the whole area being gentrified.
Well, but at the same time, that old multi-storey car park is an eyesore and a danger. I think several people have died in there from overdoses and falling off it and so on. It's definitely got to be improved.
But Matthew, I think the question here really is luxury flats, which Fifth Capital are planning, or something which is a bit more social housing?
Well, I agree with one of the local councillors, actually, Gus Hoyt, Green councillor. He's called on the mayor at the last council meeting to increase the amount of social housing, and it does need to be something for the community. I mean, you clearly understand the feeling there from the community that they don't want big plus flats where it's just going to benefit investors. Investors are going to buy these flats and then rent them out to families at a massive cost, you know. And as we know now, with the new Acorn letting started, that's being introduced in Bristol, somebody's flats are not up to scratch and the landlords are unscrupulous. So there's nearly 1,000 objections, I believe. I think there's a few short of 1,000 objections. And, you know, so that those numbers don't come from a lack of feeling within the area.
Yeah, well, I think the real problem is the planning law, because it means that they've been able to sit on that piece of land for donkey's years and not done anything with it. I mean, they're basically just speculating against the price of it. And then, as you say, Tony, they're probably not even going to build anything on it. They've just been put under enormous pressure to come up with a plan so that they can then say they've got a plan so that they can't be compulsorily purchased. Well, I would argue that places like that should have been compulsory purchased years ago.
Well, Matthew, what people argue is that was a land bank, basically. It was just the people who bought it, these Fifth Capital people now who apparently own it, they're not property developers, they're property speculators. They're just buying the land in the hope that it will rise in value and that sometime in the future they can sell it rather than do anything else with it.
Well, it would certainly seem that way, and again, I agree with Martin on this point. I call up on George Ferguson, the mayor, to obviously do the best he can in terms of our local planning and development strategy, and to sort of, you know, put as much pressure on these developers as possible to do something with the land. If that's a compulsory purchase order, then so be it. However, we all know that these loopholes exist. They've existed for long times within national government, you know, and it's one of those controversial things that we all probably dislike on the ground, you know, at base level here.
Just looking into a little bit more into the story about Avon and Somerset and Wiltshire, the Western Gazette are telling us a bit more, actually, and they're saying that there's going to be each partner will have an equal voice in this new programme. They're going to set up something called the Strategic Alliance Board, which will be jointly chaired by both the police and crime commissioners and will include both the chief constables so that they can all agree on what services should be shared. I would imagine most of them are, to begin with anyway, the civilian support services rather than the actual operational policing. But yes, you're right, we should have a chat with Kevin on this next time he comes in and find out exactly what's going on. Also, just to let you know, there's been a very bad accident today, actually, on Brunel Way, which is that great big flyover, the dual carriageway flyover that goes across the docks over in the west of the city. If you're, for example, you're heading out towards Portishead in that direction, or else or to Western Supermare, and that way, A370 Coronation Road, Westminster westbound, in a terrible mess, and Broomwell Way completely closed. So I would suggest you try and find a different route to get home, maybe go up north of the city and then down it through the M5, something like that, if you're heading out sort of south west Bristol direction. Also, Bristol's to get a new school in the basement of the Central Library. That was announced this week. Some people annoyed about it, some people happy about it. The basement of Bristol Central Library will welcome hundreds of new primary school children after council's approved controversial plans for the transformation. They've got permission to convert the lower ground floor and basement of the Edwardian Grade 1 listed library, which has been used for storage. The scheme has triggered widespread protest when first revealed nearly 2 years ago. Objectors fear pupils will be working in poor light and the move would lead to a dumbing down of the library and possibly its eventual closure. What are your thoughts about this one, Matthew?
Well, I don't think it's going to lead to the eventual closure of the library. I think, you know, a central library is paramount to any city, and I think it's attractive to have that there. So I don't think any mayor, whether it be George or the next, you know, or possibly the next mayor, will see that shut. However, it's always going to be controversial when you're taking book space away from people, as we've all heard with the library consultations and the possibility of closures. People are very passionate about libraries. So for me, I mean, again, it sounds to me as like it's been granted. A new school within the city might well be needed for the Cabot Ward.
Cathedral Primary School is Bristol's first primary free school, opened at Abbey House in College Square in September 2013. Moving to the library building will enable it to provide 420 places for children. In a report to councillors, planning officers said that while catchment area goes well beyond Bristol, the new places would go towards addressing a substantial amount of the demand for primary places within the locality. Also worth mentioning that people who are managing and governing that school are merchant venturers, so not surprising that our ex-merchant venturer mayor is behind this, Martin.
Yeah, well, strangely enough, as you know, one of his supporters who stood in as part of his campaign, who's been on this show, was
Christine Townsend.
Yeah, she's very opposed to this because she's a teacher. And of course the point is the free schools and all the rest of it does create an extremely fragmented system. The catchment area for this school runs outside Bristol, so you could have people who are not even from Bristol City having places in this school where local kids won't necessarily get a look in. And in any case, you've got to ask yourself, is that where the most need is? And of course this whole free school philosophy is just run them up all over the place, and the catchment areas are completely random, and there's no real plan behind any of this. And whatever else you can say about that, that is not the cheap way to do it. Cheap way to do it is to actually have a plan.
Okay, we've also had this week, coming to a bit of a sticky one for you, Matthew, because Grant Shapps has been revealed to be a liar and a bully. He's threatened to sue a constituent over having a second job. And he said, "How dare you suggest I have a second job? And if you don't retract what you've said, I will take you to court, I'll sue you." And yet he did have a second job. This is the sort of thing that totally discredits your party, isn't it, Matthew, when you've got someone who's actually bullying and lying and trying to actually, the people who were the subjects of this, his own constituents, were worried about losing their home because he was lying in a court threatening court letter.
Well, again, I mean, I don't know enough about the story to go into it too much. However, I mean...
Well, let me just explain a little, because Grant Shapps sought compensation in lieu of damages from one of his constituents and demanded that he post an apology over claims about the Conservative chairman's use of the name Michael Green while he was an MP in a second job. And then we've heard he's finally admitted that he was posing as this Michael Green and did have a second job. And not only that, he's suing someone who was telling the truth, one of his local constituents, and talking about it.
Well, yeah, I think it's very damaging for Grant Shapps. I don't think it's a problem for the party. It's a problem for the leader of the party to decide what he wants to do.
But he's still in the party, surely. I mean, any sensible leader would be saying, right, OK, Grant, that's it, mate. We've got an election coming up. Even if it's, it wasn't before an election, it does discredit the party to have someone like this still kept in place, doesn't it?
Well, again, it's the leader's decision of the party, the National Party. Again, I mean, I'm sure other MPs of other parties have made mistakes and lied. However, it's the party leader's decision at the end of the day. I mean, we have some facts in front of us here on a bit of paper. So does David Cameron. Cameron is the man to deal with this, and I hope he deals with it swiftly. And again, we do have an election. My priority to that election is our local MP. I believe in that person. National party stuff, I'm sure there's plenty of people dealing that for me.
Martin, this is pretty embarrassing for Grant Shapps and the Conservative Party, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, at one stage he said, when he was being, we're trying to bite back this off, he said, "Labour just hate business," because he was in business and he thought that was an excuse. I think the real underlying issue here that does need to be dealt with, not just by the Conservative Party, but in general, is MPs having second jobs. What is legitimate and what is not legitimate on that front? And originally, of course, I mean, the MPs got didn't used to have salaries back in the day. They were gentlemen of leisure. And, of course, giving them salaries was part of opening up the possibility for anybody to be an MP. But, of course, they still kept, many of them, their other jobs. And if you were a top civil servant, for example, it wouldn't be acceptable to spend half your week on your private business. And I think we've got to... I mean, at the very least, people should be honest about what they're up to. But I think there's a big question mark over whether we should allow MPs to have large outside interests other than doing their job, which is what they're supposed to be doing.
I actually agree with Martin on that one. Essentially, I believe that an MP is paid to be at Parliament for Monday to Friday, or at least Monday to Thursday night, I believe it is. I don't disagree that they should have business interest and obviously manage their portfolio in the evenings or in their own time. But like you said, a top civil servant couldn't spend that much time away from their job. So, again, it's a cross-party need to discuss this and, come up with an answer with second jobs.
Well, don't you have a serious problem here, particularly since he's Conservative Party chairman? He's the person who's supposed to be policing this. In a way, he is David Cameron's boss, chairman of the party. I mean, we've got a problem with David Cameron as well. He's seeing the ministerial code, and yet he some would allege, has been breaking it himself. I mean, particularly with this thing we had last year with the Bilderberg meeting. Quite obviously, it's against the ministerial code to go to secret meetings with big bankers in big business where there's no kind of scrutiny at all and where you're sworn to secrecy. You're not allowed to do that in the ministerial code. David Cameron has been overseeing that code, and he hasn't said about himself, I shouldn't do that, and disciplined himself. The same here, really, with Grant Shapps. Is he likely to discipline himself for being caught out over this court threatening court letter and this Michael Green company that he's running?
Well, again, I mean, in terms of discipline himself, I'm sure David Cameron will, you know, do what he needs to do to, you know, to, as you said, protect the party. But in reality, he's not the first person to have made a mistake within any party, you know, in Parliament.
But he must have known that he had this other identity. I mean, it's not really a mistake, is it?
Well, if indeed it is true, then he's, as we were saying in my area, he's banged to rights.
Martin, I would have expected he'd have sued every newspaper and the BBC if it wasn't true. Martin, the point here, I suppose, with both Grant Shapps as chairman of the Conservative Party and David Cameron as the party leader, is how can you expect people to police themselves in this sort of situation?
Well, I think there's a general culture of it's okay. I mean, it's been there for years. I mean, John Smith years ago was approached by sort of Tory colleagues and said to him, "What? It's ridiculous. You're a top barrister, and you are leading the Labour Party for $30,000 a year." And this was back in the 80s, you know, and the 90s. And he said they just didn't seem to get it because the people in the Tory Party. I'm sorry to be party political about this, but traditionally, you either were super wealthy and it's a hobby, or you get wealthy by being in the party. And that's certainly how right-wing politics in the US works. It's actually a gravy train. And, of course, that is a problem, which it's a perception problem for all MPs, but it's a particular problem for the Tories.
But, well, I mean, when you tell a barefaced lie and threaten your constituent, you would have thought that's a sackable offence, surely. But the thing is, he's the guy charged with making that decision.
Well Cameron's decision will be based on how far this goes in the media. He might be prepared to give him a slap on the wrist and say, carry on. But if the media will keep running with it, and we're running with it today, it just becomes toxic for him, and he's just got to stand down. And I'm sure there's going to be plenty of things like this between now and election day for all the party leaders.
I suppose UKIP
have got a similar problem today with one of their people fiddling their expenses. Yeah. So there's going to be a lot of this stuff.
But I mean, you would have thought if the parties are serious about trying to win votes at the election, they would make sure that when something like this happens, at least if someone's discovered that they're removed. Anyway,
well, you may well be right.
Let's go on to the bigger subject this week, which is the budget this week. It's a bit funny, isn't it, when you've got an election coming up just after the budget, because the budget, you're thinking, well, actually, there'll be another budget after the election, if some different party gets in. So it's all a little bit pointless. But anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about the budget this week?
Well, it's not pointless, because it's an important inflection point in the debate running up to
the
election.
It's part of the campaign, I suppose, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there's no big surprises there, is there? I mean, pretty much, the only thing, what I've been reading is that he has backed off to some extent from some of the spending cuts that he was flagging up last autumn. And I think that's because it's kind of gone down badly with focus groups and so on. That's the main takeaway I've got. But, of course, I still think the basic philosophy behind what's going on is wrong, as you know, as I say every week. The real fundamental problem we face is that the banking system's insolvent, and it could be that Alex Tsipras and Varoufakis will blow the banking system out of the water before we reach May the 7th.
How will they do that from Greece?
Because all they've got to do is default on their debt and leave the euro, and that actually brings down the Greek and French banks.
But we're not in the euro.
Matter, though. The banking system is interlinked. That's why everybody's terrified. This is what they've been threatening. If you want us to leave the euro, maybe we will. And if they do, then they default on their debt. The derivatives contracts based on that debt then come due. And then the banking system goes down the drain. So now, it's going to go down the drain sooner or later anyway. Although the electoral campaign in the mainstream in this country is based on... They don't want to frighten the children and say, actually, in actual fact, we're on the Titanic here. They don't want to say that. Nobody wants to say that because nobody wants to hear it. It's not just because they're deliberately deceiving people. A, many mainstream politicians don't understand this stuff. frankly, and B, even when they do, they know that ordinary folk don't understand it, so frightening them by saying, actually, we're on the brink of a volcanic eruption here is not what people want to hear. But it may be that that volcano will blow up before May the 7th, and the party leaders, Cameron, Miliband, the rest of them, will have to respond. If
well,
that's
I think it's today, isn't it? The gunfight at the OK Corral with the Greeks, yeah, well, the Greeks and the Germans negotiating.
Yeah, they have, but they've come up with another kind of "we're fixing it, just leave it with us."
Kicking the can down the road. Anyway, what are your thoughts, Matthew, about the sort of bigger picture of the big world of macroeconomics? Because it does affect us, doesn't it? It's just difficult to know exactly how.
I think because of the EU and obviously the Chinese sort of empire is forming across there, and the American obviously sort of economic situation, it does affect us. But I don't think that the Greek situation will bring the country down. We'll all be in the sort of the Stone Age, and that'll be the end of the world. And as Martin, obviously,
I wouldn't say the Stone Age.
No, but as Martin would have you believe that it's going to be that bad. I mean, it's in their interest, the MPs and the government and the economists, want interest as well, to protect us and to see us go. And even after May, if it becomes a different government, then they're the same. They're going to fight, to protect our system of banking. Now, however, what's going on in Greece might be a lesson for the future of the EU when they invite these smaller countries in with no real means to, play with the big boys. Is essentially what's happened, then they shouldn't be inviting these little member states into the EU.
The latest, I think you're right, Martin, looking at some of the news feeds, is that they are kicking the can down the road again. Ultimately, though, what's going to happen? Are the Greeks going to exit? Is the whole house of cards going to come down?
Yes, ultimately it will. If it's not the Greeks, it'll be something else. This is what the main point I'm making about the financial system. It is incredibly fragile. I mean, David Cameron, when he came back from Australia from the G20 summit, said the red lights are flashing on the dashboard of the international economy. He was right. But of course, we're in a kind of
do they do this sort of thing on a Friday evening on purpose because they know all the markets are closing for 2 days?
Yes, of course.
Is that right?
Do.
So the outcome of it doesn't affect shares over the weekend.
Yes.
But then they can decide on Monday.
The derivatives bubble is bigger now than it was in 2008, and any kind of shock, it might be the Greek exit, or it could be something else. I mean, the oil price is creating undercutting the fracking bubble in the US. There's all the Chinese property market is way overvalued. Any of these things can bring the whole lot down, and it's very difficult because our politics inevitably is based around discussing national issues in a national framework. But that's not really the framework in which we're operating.
So you seem quite versed in this, Martin. Obviously, what would be the outcome for Greece? Greece were to walk away now and default on their loan, what would be the outcome?
Well, the outcome would be pretty dramatically bad for them.
But
they would wipe out their debt. That's all that would happen.
But I mean,
you don't have to pay your debts. There is no rule that says you have to pay your debts.
But if you don't pay your debt the first time, what happens the next time you want to borrow money?
Well, you can't borrow money. On the other hand, you've then got to start from scratch.
Would they be talking? Do you think they've been negotiating behind the scenes with the Russians and the Chinese?
Well, they are negotiating behind the scenes with the Russians and the Chinese because they may say, right, well, we can actually cushion our exit from the euro with a Russian bridging loan or a Chinese bridging loan. And of course, the Chinese can pay for a bridging loan to Greece relatively easily. It's not a huge amount of money for them. It's only a tiny country. But I mean, what's shocking is a tiny country like that is in a position to pull the whole system down because the system's it's just a house of cards. That's the trouble with it.
But in essence, again, the story goes on. Where would be the plus side for the Russians or indeed the Chinese to lend money to a country that has defaulted on a massive loan, has no real sort of income in the sense of apart from tourism and
Well, let me say something there because they do have quite a lot of frontage in the Mediterranean, so it might be a military decision.
Yeah, well, you see, this is where the military thing starts to kick in. Cyprus, the Cyprus have agreed to give the Russians a base, which is part of them sticking a finger up to Britain, which has got a base on the other end of Cyprus. But I mean, the point is that it's just very fragile. I mean, the world economy is actually, in a very, very fragile state. I mean, the British economy is growing a bit, but it's based on essentially a property bubble. There's nothing new there, and that, as we know, is not really a stable basis from which on which to grow. And this is not really a party political point, because whoever's in charge, they're going to be dealing with this. It's all maybe Greece shouldn't have been allowed in the euro.
No.
Maybe the euro shouldn't have been designed in the way it was. Maybe we shouldn't have deregulated the financial markets in the 1980s and allowed the derivatives bubble to. It's all by the by now, because we're now where we are.
Yeah.
And it's a dangerous place.
Okay, the head of the influential think tank, getting back to the budget, which is where we started, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, says Osborne's failed to set out his plans in sufficient detail. He's been saying this for the last 2 years and has given us almost no details about what that actually looks like. That is, cutting welfare spending by £12 billion and clamping down on tax avoidance. So the words are there, but the detail isn't, Martin.
Well, I mean, the stuff I've been reading suggests that he wants to make most of the cuts from welfare. Again, there's a question of how much money is actually there. He's not specified it because they've been trying to cut the welfare bill, and it's actually quite difficult. And especially if the economy takes a dive, the welfare bill goes up pretty automatically because the tax receipts go down and benefit payments go up. So I think what I get from the last few years is that he has in fact eased up on austerity, and he's pretty much done what a Labour Chancellor would have done, which is cut, but not as dramatically as he intended in the first place. Now, you could argue from his point of view that you want to sound tough, like being a supply teacher. You want to put the fear of God into them and then ease up a bit. But effectively, we've ended up pretty much where we might have ended up with a Labour government, because there would have been cuts, but they wouldn't have been so dramatic. But nevertheless, the underlying problem, as I keep pointing out, is that the banking system is still insolvent.
I mean, how can we have welfare cuts? Ken Loach was at this Homes for Britain rally in central London earlier this week, and I was there actually, sitting in the audience watching it all. And he came up with, this is the director that did Cathy Come Home, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, various other films. And one of the things he said, when Cathy Come Home was made back in 1966, homelessness was a major issue. Husbands were separated from their families because they had no home. There was terrible poverty. It was a horror story. And Loach feels the housing situation has a long way to go. He says it's much worse now. Much worse now, he told the audience. 93,000 children homeless. What a disgrace in this rich, rich country. And of course, we're the sixth richest country in the world. Now, where is that going to leave more benefit cuts? We've already got 93,000 homeless children.
Well, essentially, I mean, as far as I understood the budget, it wasn't about benefit cuts. It was about designing a new welfare system that pays to work. Now, in reality, there are people out there that are not getting the right amount of benefits, might not be getting enough, might be getting too much. Now, my understanding that he wants to design a system that is fit for purpose.
Isn't the real job here, though, to actually make increase wages? So when you do get a job, you're not still on benefits. That seems to be the problem for so many people now.
Well, obviously, if you earn money and you keep your job, then in reality, it's going to benefit the economy. Now, in terms of housing, you mentioned housing. There's no doubt about it. There is a housing shortage in this country, social housing and houses to buy. People can't afford to buy, wherever they work, can't afford to get, you can't get a social house, if they don't. Now, there needs to be some sort of money for social building houses. All the parties have said, well, we're going to find this money to build these houses. We're going to find this money to build those houses. Now, we heard Natalie Bennett, when she mentioned about her 500,000 houses, and then when asked to cost it, it wasn't feasible. Now, in reality, houses cost money. We don't have money. So,
well, we do. We do have it somewhere. We're the sixth richest country in the world. It must be some hanging around.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to. I mean, I think there's a general consensus in Bristol that something needs to be done about social housing. And I'm glad to see
a consensus around.
I think that's particular to Bristol. I think it's the Conservative Party in Bristol.
And in London.
Well, people around. What happened was, of course, that we sold off the council housing stock in the 1980s and we didn't replace it.
Well, it's all very well looking back.
What are we going to do about it? Well, what we've got to do is quite clearly. I mean, we've got to create. At the bottom, people need low cost but relatively high quality accommodation, and to some extent you have to subsidise that, and you've got to accept that you've got to subsidise it, especially if you're going to have people, even in London you're going to need people to do the cleaning and what have you, and they need to live somewhere. They can't commute from Middlesbrough, can they? So there used to be a general understanding about this, that in the 1950s, the Macmillan government was the biggest builder of council houses. It wasn't, in fact, the Tories.
It wasn't,
in fact, the Labour government that did it. The Labour government initiated it, but the Tories carried it through.
Just after.
And there was a general consensus across the board then that owning your own home was not for everybody, which it isn't.
Well,
you know, some people are never going to have enough resources to own their own home. So you're going to have to find some way of giving them a relatively decent standard of accommodation without, you know... And, of course, the mortgage industry in Britain is a huge boom and bust thing. It creates all sorts of instabilities in the way we make decisions.
No, I agree with some of what you've said there. I mean, in reality, if you say 30% of people, you know, in a sense, need social housing, and the other 70% should be aspiring to buy, then that is the step... percentage of a private development. 30% social, 70% for the private development.
I mean, for example, we've had recently, though, the Bristol General Hospital site, which was sold off by the United Hospitals Bristol University Hospital. No, United, isn't it? The NHS Trust in the city centre, anyway. The developers said they put a proportion of social housing, something like 15%, 20% social housing. And once they bought the site, they then stuck two fingers up to the council and said, actually, we're not going to do any because it's just not viable. And we're going to leave it as a bomb site. Well, not quite as a bomb site, but we're going to mothball the site until you say we can do 100% luxury housing.
Well, again, this goes back to the issue with the carriage works and the planning consent. I think there's a disgrace that they should be allowed to do that.
I mean, so they're just sitting on it land banking at the moment. I was past here the other day. They've demolished all the more modern bits of that hospital and they've left the old bits there ready until they get their planning permission to do luxury flats.
Again, you know,
this was our hospital.
Whereas national guidelines that allow them to do this, or it's local planning development law, at the end of the day, that's a disgrace. So that a company can, you know, promise you one thing and then take away with the other. Now, in reality, there are lots of ethical housing associations out there that would happily take the 30% and run it at a good, reasonable cost and a good standard of housing.
Okay, on to Prime Minister's questions now, and we'll start, I think, with Ed and Dave. Ed Miliband, the Leader of the Opposition, Labour Opposition, and David Cameron, the Prime Minister. And this month, or this week, they were talking about, guess what, in the run-up to the election, the National Health Service.
So, first broken promise on top-down reorganisation. Next, he said, I refuse to go back to the days when people had to wait for hours on end to be seen in A&E. Now we learn the NHS will miss the four-hour A&E target for the whole of this year for the first time ever. Yeah. Why did he break that promise?
Yeah. Well, which of his kitchens did he pay for? I think we deserve an answer. No, I do feel sorry. I feel sorry for the Leader of the Opposition. He literally doesn't know where his next meal's coming from. Oh, don't worry, there's plenty more. He asked about accident emergency. So far this year, 93.7% of people have been seen within the 4 hours. I want us to do better. We'll bring together the health and social care to make that happen. But we made a promise, which is that we would put £12.7 billion into the NHS. They said it was irresponsible. We invested in our health service.
That's the Prime Minister there. We're joined by Matthew Malias from Avonmouth, Conservative councillor. Matthew, this is a bit of a sticky one for Conservatives, isn't it? Because we had the promise of no top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service, which then happened. And also this promise over waiting times at A&E, also broken.
Well, again, I mean, in terms of waiting times at A&E, as the Prime Minister alluded to then, he's just as sorry as everyone else is. I'm sure he didn't set out to, you know, to make waiting times within the A&E departments. 97% is not perfect, but, you know, it's getting there. You know, in reality, they're putting money in towards the NHS. You know, whether it's getting results, I don't know. But lots of both parties throwing up figures to support their arguments. Classic. PM's question.
There was also that diversionary thing about the kitchen, which particularly annoyed me, because they had a thing in the Daily Mail about Ed Miliband's kitchen and saying, isn't this a rubbishy little like scullery? And it turns out it wasn't his kitchen at all. It was wasn't even in his own house, and they had a big article, a whole page about it.
Completely wrong. That's not news. It should have been.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So. Anyway, Martin.
Well, I think the biggie here is the top-down reorganisation, because I think...
It's cost money, hasn't it? That's
well,
one
it
of
is,
the reasons
and it's misconceived in all sorts of different ways. And I think that is hopefully, from my point of view, that is going to cost David Cameron badly, because I think people voted for Cameron and the Liberal Democrats last time around because they presumed that they were going to be quite centrist in their policies. Cameron had put himself forward as a not an old style free market conservative. And one of the things that the touchstones for that was saying, I'm not going to mess around with the National Health Service. We're not going to change the structure. And then, of course, it became apparent that the US health companies have been lobbying behind the scenes for a long time, and they've been lobbying New Labour as well. There's plenty of people in New Labour who have actually paid the price for this in Scotland. And, of course, once you start actually marketising the health service, it really does change it. It does change it. It's not the same. You can't just say it's any provider can provide it. The planning has gone out of it.
Okay, now on to cancer treatment. Another question about that was raised by Fiona McTaggart.
Fiona McTaggart.
The Prime Minister, when he answered the Leader of the Opposition, was able to show that the cancer waiting targets had been met in his constituency. They obviously have a very effective Member of Parliament. Yeah. But actually... is responsible for the National Health Service as a whole. And he will be aware that nationally, the 62-day wait for treatment for cancer patients after referral has been breached in each of the last four quarters. So what does he have to say to the over 5,000 cancer patients, including one in four people with bowel or lung cancer, who are waiting months before they get any treatment?
Say, look, everybody in this house, me included, knows people who've been affected by cancer and have died of cancer. And this government has put an enormous amount of effort, as previous ones have done. I will answer the question. I will answer the question very directly. Right? And we have made sure...
Order! Order! Members must hear the answer. It must be, order! I said it a moment ago to the other side. The Prime Minister must be heard. The Right Honourable Gentleman.
I'm sure that 500,000 more people have been referred for cancer treatment, and as a result, cancer survival rates are going up. Now, I do think it's worthwhile, as well as looking at the national figures, looking at the constituency figures. And I have her figures here. She's obviously a very effective MP too, because in her area, they are meeting all three of the cancer targets. That's what's happening in Britain. More people referred, more resources going in, more people surviving, but more to be done. But let me remind her, this can only happen with a strong economy. It's when the Labour Party wrecked the economy that they wrecked the health service.
Well, Martin, he's got a point there, hasn't he? It's no good trying to run a health service when you've been left with a disastrous economy.
Well, the economy is not wrecked by the Labour Party wrecked the economy in the sense by not regulating the city for 13 years when they had the opportunity.
So they did wreck the economy.
Well, the Conservative Party were perfectly happy for that to continue. George Osborne was suggesting that we should have the light touch regulation of the Irish economy. I think underlying all of this, as I said earlier, is that the financial sector is insolvent. Not illiquid, insolvent. That means that it is going to crash at some point. We're not out of the woods, far from it.
So where do they get their cash from then?
Where do who get their cash from?
The financial sector.
They get their cash from the quantitative easing, which we pioneered with the Americans, and of course the Germans have been very resistant to, although they've now had their arms twisted up their backs and have agreed to it, basically bails out the wealth-owning classes. What you're doing is saying, instead of having a crash, and this is all clear in, if you read, the von Mises Institute and the true free marketeers are very critical of quantitative easing and everything that it represents. And of course, what you're doing is basically bailing out the losing bets of the financial services sector.
Okay,
and that means there's no money for anything else.
Before we hear from Matthew on the NHS, let's have another question from this week. That is from Theresa Pierce on the long waiting times for GP appointments.
Theresa Pierce!
One in four patients are waiting over a week for a GP appointment, and some are waiting 2 weeks in my constituency. A third can't even get through on the phone. And yet we have 23% of London GPs due to quit the NHS in the next 5 years. Will the Prime Minister take responsibility for the increasing crisis in GPs on his watch?
Yeah.
Well, what I'd say to the Honourable Lady is nationwide we have 1,000 more GPs in the NHS. In her own constituency, there are 8 more GPs compared with 2010. There are 317 more GPs in the London area. And the Royal College of GPs, who's often criticised this government, has said actually now there's never been a better time to go into general practice.
Matthew Malias, Conservative Councillor of Avonmouth. What are your thoughts about generally about the cancer treatment, the waiting times for GPs? Because it's starting to stack up as going to be a big election issue, the NHS.
As we all know, the NHS is on a massive strain. You know, I mean, the budget for the NHS clearly isn't enough. Now, where do you get that extra money from? I don't know, whether that's a reorganisation of the NHS.
Well, I mean, there's been a reorganisation. Surely it's not the best time to do it if the cash is under strain. Because you're spending loads of money on trying to reorganise, rejig things.
Agreed. Maybe an organisation from, with NHS staff and some of the people that actually know a little bit more about what happens on the ground floor. Possibly, I don't know. I mean, like the Prime Minister said, cancer patients, survivors are up. He's not setting out to increase waiting time. He's put money into that sort of sector. GPs, 1,000 more GPs within the country. Now we can put out statistics for a constituency. And then as for the UK, whatever benefits your argument, it's the bottom line. Now we all know that when we go to a GP, it's very hard to get an appointment. It is under massive strain. But in reality, I think this government and the next government, if it isn't a Conservative government, will still try to improve on that.
Well, a bit of a bombshell on Monday. Metropolitan Police investigated themselves over child sex abuse cover-up claims involving MPs and officers. The police watchdog is investigating allegations of historic high-level corruption of the most serious nature. Scotland Yard's to be investigated over claims it covered up child sex offences due to the involvement of both MPs and police officers. The Independent Police Complaints Commission said it's investigating allegations of historic high-level corruption of the most serious nature in the Metropolitan Police Force, being probed over 14 fresh referrals made to the IPCC detailing alleged corruption in the force relating to child sexual offences in the 1970s all the way up to 2005, including claims that Met suppressed evidence, hindered or halted investigations and covered up offences because MPs and police officers had been involved. Now, this is simply not on, and Labour MP Tom Watson brought it up at Prime Minister's Questions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This week it was revealed that a second criminal inquiry into former member of this House, Sir Cyril Smith, was closed down by senior police officers. I believe there will be other examples of cover-up yet to be revealed. Notwithstanding the reassurances of the Home Secretary, will the Prime Minister please give a cast-iron guarantee that former public officials with knowledge of the cover-ups are given full whistleblower protections?
I'm grateful the Honourable Gentleman has asked this question, because I think it comes down to three separate questions, because there's this concern about whether people would be prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. Now, in terms of people giving evidence to the Goddard Review, Justice Goddard is perfectly able to ask the Attorney General, as has happened with all previous commissions of inquiry of this type, to make sure that no one can incriminate themselves when they give evidence, and I'm sure that will happen. In terms of giving evidence to the IPCC inquiry, the Home Secretary has given very clear guidance on that issue, and in terms of disclosing to the press, the Attorney General said very recently it would be highly unlikely that it would ever be in the public interest for someone who did that, a revealing wrongdoing, to be subject to prosecution. I'm absolutely clear, I don't want to see anyone prosecuted for uncovering wrongdoing in this way, and I hope he will take that in the spirit in which it's meant.
Well, interesting, Martin. I mean, we were hearing this week from one of the detectives involved in this that was investigating MPs, public figures for child abuse, talking about a kind of X-Files situation where he's in the middle of an investigation. Somebody from possibly, he's not saying exactly who, MI5, comes into the room and tells him, we're taking all of that investigation away. Your entire investigation is gone in a box, and it disappears.
Yeah, well, when Ken Livingstone was elected to Parliament originally in the 90s, I think, he made his maiden speech about the Kinkora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, and the main allegation there is that it was being used by MI5 as a honey trap. So various political and paramilitary people were going there to have sex with the underage boys. They were being filmed and they were being blackmailed. And I suspect that this is the real nasty twist in this whole saga, Heyman, who was second in command of MI6, has been named as one of the people involved in all of this. The police found some child pornographic material and tried to prosecute him, and of course, it being head of deputy head of MI6, he was able to get away with it. And it's not just that these people have got a kind of particular, you know, peccadilloes and they're getting away with them. It's also the systematic use of this, the systematic use of child sex as a means of blackmail by the security services, which is the real underlying story here.
Now, Matthew, there's about 15 different allegations listed in the article in the Independent on Monday. One of them, for example, is an allegation into an investigation into a paedophile ring in which a number of people were convicted and they did not take action in relation to the more prominent individuals. So cherry-picking, the people who are prominent don't get prosecuted, the people who aren't do. Now, I mean, this is it gets rid of the idea that nobody's above the law, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, it's exactly what it does. I mean, do I need to say it? It's disgraceful, disgusting, what would have sort of the words you might want to come up with this sort of thing. In reality, I mean, anyone that covered it up in motor and all the that's sort of, you know, perverting the course of justice, and that carries a sentence of probably up to 10 years. Now charge them, book them, and put him inside. It's as simple as that. You know, investigate it. There is no cost implications to this. Put the money you need to get to it to find out what happened.
I mean, you say perverting the course of justice. One of the allegations is that an account provided by a victim of abuse was altered to omit the name of a senior politician.
Well, again, you know, it's disgraceful. We have sort of allegations. Every one of them needs to be investigated. People at the time of Jimmy Savile said that some of these allegations might well be false, or because he's a celebrity they were trying to tar his name, and look what happened. We find out that in reality a hell of a lot were true.
Well, he turned out to be the biggest child abuser in British history, it seems, certainly the 20th century, and yet there he was on children's TV with children sitting on his lap. Absolutely appalling for any organisation to allow that to happen.
Well, it's clear to me that the investigation, you know, out of the Jimmy Savile case needs to continue. It needs to continue to investigate all these allegations. The whistleblowers need to be protected. And therefore, and the full weight of the law needs to be applied to these people.
Well, the one positive thing we can say about all this is it started to be talked about for the first time, really, for decades. And for a lot of people who have been abused in the past, maybe have gone to authority figures, maybe even gone to the police and found that they got short shrift in the past, I think it's time to do it again, because I think it'll be taken much more seriously. So whatever you might say about Jimmy Savile, at least hopefully he's allowed these prosecutions to go forward. But it is worrying when we think there may be even still serving MPs on that list, and the sooner, because we hear a lot about the dead ones like Cyril Smith.
Yes.
What about arresting and jailing some of those that are still alive? And final story this week, rising numbers of suicides in jails linked to spending cuts. Justice Secretary Chris Grayling is accused of presiding over a full-blown crisis in the country's prisons. Growing levels of suicide, self-harm and violence behind bars are linked to deep spending cuts to the prison system, a damning parliamentary report concluded on Tuesday. Specialist riot squads are now being sent to jails every other day to quell unrest, Martin.
Well, have we got the money to do what we need to do in prisons? And the answer is no, because we've basically bailed out the banks instead of the people.
Matthew, what do you make of this? It's pretty frightening, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is frightening if indeed these accusations are true and these figures are true.
Well, I mean, I've spoken to people who worked in the prison service who have left simply because they're saying it's too dangerous to work in the prison service.
Well, yeah, again, I must agree. I've spoken to people myself. For a friend of mine works in the police service, and again, he has noticed the fact that there are less, you know, screws about on the shop floor. I mean, whether that leads to suicides, I don't know. You know what I mean? In reality, that may not be the case, but it's certainly, it's not on that there are less police guards within our prisons.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guests, Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth, Matthew Malias. After the Murdoch News, the BBC are in court next week for aiding and abetting terrorism.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.